We talk a lot about jobs in our house, as you might imagine. Cooper already has his first real job. Drew is looking for one, and Austin knows that the time is coming when he too will want one. Kathy and I look at jobs for them in a couple of ways. It's a way for them to keep occupied. It gives them valuable experience with both interpersonal relationships and the expectations of supervisors and clients, while their basic attitude is money. I'm sure there's something more to it somewhere in their minds, but I doubt that there's much more right now. Eventually, though, careers will come into this discussion more and more often, as they will each have to choose what they want to do in their lives. They have ideas now, but we all know that these will change as they get further and further into high school and experience some of the things that are there to be experienced. They could be in a skilled trade, a business, a scientific field. You know, right now, the whole world is open to them. And the only limits they really have are their own imaginations and whatever personal abilities or interests, or lack thereof, might keep them from doing one thing or another. The time will come, though, when they have to choose what they want to do. And that'll be probably followed by the question of where to go to train for it. I knew a fellow years ago, he wanted to be in forestry. There were only two colleges that offered forestry programs in Ontario, Ottawa and Thunder Bay. And he went all the way up north to Thunder Bay, to Confederation College, to learn the forestry trade. Sometimes there's also the question of who you might want to learn from, and that can significantly impact on the where. Another friend of mine wanted to be a military historian, and so he decided that he was going to go to Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo and study under Professor Terry Kopp for 4 years. One of his other choices was to go to York University, where Jack Granitstein was lecturing, both of them giants in the Canadian military history field. I mean, seriously, if we have the ability to choose and we know who the best is, most of us would love the opportunity to learn from that person, either the best program or the best individual in the field, and not necessarily in school. I know that. The great jazz trumpeter Miles Davis attended Juilliard School in New York City for 1 year. And then he dropped out to go play with Charlie Parker in his band. If you learn from the best, the hope is that one day you will be the best yourself. Now, if for some reason we can't learn directly from the best, another option is to hold ourselves to the standard that we see being demonstrated by the best. Mike Holmes, star of both Homes on Homes and more recently Homes Inspection, was voted Canada's most trusted contractor a couple of years ago. People watched his show and want their homes to be built to his standards, not the minimum code that he is always deriding as inadequate. On the other hand, are contractors who want to do work that Mike Holmes would approve of, that he might come in and look at and say, yeah, that's a job done right. That was good work. I was reading this week about a couple of contracting networks that he has set up, selected contractors that do have his stamp of approval and to whom he would direct people if he couldn't do the job himself. And when you consider that, by times, he can receive hundreds of requests to come and look at something or do a job. He can receive hundreds of requests per week to do this. The vast majority of the work he has to give off to these other contractors. Now, I have talked to people in construction, contractors, house builders, and that, and some of them are a little frustrated. They think that Mike Holmes has set the bar maybe a little too high in terms of, people want their homes and their renovations done to Mike Holmes' standard, but they don't necessarily want to pay all the costs that come with a house built to that standard in terms of materials and extra steps taken. I can tell you, though, Then I have a leak in my foundation wall that comes into our laundry room and now dribbles into the floor drain. Thank you, Keith. I wish somebody had taken the extra step of having our foundation waterproofed when it was built all those years ago. That was a choice that the builder or whoever didn't think about or didn't know could be made. And that's the thing with choices. For some of them, you know the outcome instantly, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong. I mean, if I were to choose to jump out the window of the church, I would know pretty quickly that that was a bad choice. Other choices, you may not have a clear view of the outcome for years to come. A wrong choice now may take a very long time to show up as a mistake, and when it does, you kick yourself and you say, why did I do that? I wish I'd made a better choice when I had a chance. And conversely, a right decision can also take years to show fruit. When one decides to go into business for oneself, say, a client list, complete client list, doesn't just show up overnight. It may be some time before you're actually able to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and say, yeah, that was the right thing to do. But I want to talk to you this morning about choices in relation to God. First, there really only is one choice when you get down to the black and white nitty gritty. There's God's way and there's not God's way. Second point is, this is not a one-time choice. We face this decision 20 times a day, maybe 100 times a day, in large and small ways that we may not even see for what they are. And third, God can take a choice, any choice, and work with it and make the outcome on the far side into something good in the long run if we're willing to put it into His hands to do so. Consider what we heard in our reading from the book of Joshua. The Hebrews had crossed the River Jordan. They had swept into Canaan, conquering cities and driving opposing forces ahead of them. This was the land that had been promised to Abraham over 400 years earlier, and they were finally here to collect. They were a people hardened by years of wandering in the desert who knew that if they failed and survived, it was back to living in tents and wandering as nomads, trying to scratch out a living of some kind in the wilderness. They had nothing to lose and everything to gain. And the promise that God was with them as they went drove them to victory after victory. But by this point in the book, the conquest was over. The elders and representatives of all 12 tribes gathered at the Valley of Shechem to hear one last time as a group the voice of the man who had led them through the wilderness, the last man to remember what slavery in Egypt really looked like. He reminded them of their past, but he told them that it was over, that everything starts from right here. Now, says Joshua, you need to make a decision. Whose gods will you follow? Will they be the gods that Abraham served before God called him? They are still worshipped. The temples and shrines are still on the hilltops. People still go to them. You'll see your neighbors go up to worship, and they'll encourage you to come with them. Will you go, or will you stay true to the God who's brought you to this place? As recently as two generations ago, we were slaves in a place with a God for every moment of every day, a history older than Abraham, with beautiful and elaborate rituals that your fathers and mothers sought to copy at the foot of the mountain, even though Moses was just up in the cloud with God. Will you try to bring those gods here, gods of wood and stone and clay in the form of birds and animals? Or will you stay true to the God who has delivered you to this place? I can't make the decision for you, but I will tell you that I and everyone in my household, we will be following the way of the one God, the God who brought us through water and wilderness to be here now in this land that was promised to us. Now the people said at that moment that they would stand with Joshua, that they would stand with God, that nothing would change their stance, their beliefs, or their attitudes. We also will serve the Lord, for He is our God, they said. And yet the very next book in our Bibles, the book of Judges, tells extensively of the waxing and waning of the people's faith and relationship with God. Now the story is told, they're not on a day-to-day scale, not even on a month-to-month or year-to-year scale, but generation to generation. That scale, however, doesn't happen without the day-to-day breakdown on the lower level, the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, and so on. Casting Crowns has a very powerful song called Slow Fade, which talks about a family that's headed for breakup and divorce. It doesn't happen overnight, the song says, but comes as a result of a slow and gradual breakdown of things that were once taken for granted, as a result of day-to-day choices that don't honor and glorify God. This goes back to that second point I mentioned. We are faced with God, not God, choices multiple times in a day, whether we realize it or not. And it's when we find ourselves tending to make the not God choices more often than the other that we find ourselves drifting in our relationship with Him. But here's where grace comes into it. You see, God stayed with His people. He let them falter, let them fail, got angry with them, but always promised a way out. He did appoint the judges to return the people to the right path and allow them to see and hear about His power and presence in their lives. He sent prophets to speak with them, and sometimes the people listened, sometimes they didn't. They went into exile. Another two generations of living in a foreign land, but He brought them back. And finally, He sent them Jesus. Not just to them, not just to the Jews, but to the entire world. God hated the sin, but He loved the sinners. He tried to teach, and He has tried to teach poor, stubborn humanity about Himself for well over 3,000 years. We don't deserve all these chances, all these opportunities to start over and try again, all these moments where we say, oh, I was wrong, and now I'm going to make it right. But we've been given them. That is grace. And that is where our choice comes in. I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago who had been dealing with the consequences of an abortion out in their extended family. The girl who'd gotten pregnant had decided that the pregnancy was a mistake and that she couldn't handle bringing a child into the world, along with several other justifications that essentially boil it down to, I thought I was fixing a mistake. What was thrown back at her with some vehemence was the thought that yes, the action that led to the pregnancy was a mistake. Sex without commitment, without protection, without thought for the consequences. Yes, that was a mistake. But the child that would have been born was not a mistake. Who knows what God could have done with that child's life? But now the question can become, well, who knows what God will yet do with that child's death? And just so everyone's clear, I don't fall far enough to either side to be pro-choice or pro-life. I fall between the stools. I believe that if carrying the infant to term is going to put the mother's life in danger, or if the child is a product of rape, then abortion is an option on the table. But I certainly don't believe in casual abortions so that a woman can rid herself of an inconvenience. I firmly believe in adoption, and I know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of would-be mothers out there just in Ontario who would love a chance to raise a child, even if it wasn't their own. But if this situation can be placed in God's hands, He will take what most of us view as a bad choice and potentially do something good with it. What that good is, only He can say, because the outcome will be different for everyone involved in it. God can take any situation, one that you're in by your choice, one that you're in by the choices of someone else, one that you're in through no traceable chain of choices at all, and do good things with it and work towards the outcome that He has intended in the first place for all of our lives. One way that we do that, one way that we give things to Him, is by praying and listening and trying as much as possible to be aware of choosing God's way over not God's way, of holding ourselves to as high a standard as possible as we can find in God's eyes. What is God's way? It's the way of honesty, the way of truth, the way of justice. It's also the way of prayer and faith and obedience, and the way of compassion and love and grace. God's way is generally also the way of life over death. But if death is a release from pain or serves another higher visible purpose, then it may also be God's way. I remember a story from World War II, from a concentration camp where undesirables, not necessarily Jews, had been gathered together by the Nazis. A prisoner had escaped, and the sentence was that 10 other prisoners would be starved to death in a sealed bunker. When a particular husband and father was chosen, a priest stepped up and said that he would take his place to allow that man to live. He, as a priest, had no family to live for. After a week, during which prayers and hymns were heard coming from the starvation bunker almost constantly, the Nazis had to take the step of actually executing about half of the men, including the priest. Several years later, a special mass was pronounced at St. Peter's in Rome by the Pope. And that man who had had his place taken by the priest stood in the square surrounded by his wife, his children, and his grandchildren, alive, all because of another man's choice. So next time you face a choice, small or large, if you haven't been in the habit of doing so, ask God to help you weigh the outcomes and judge according to the standard. Say, what way is your way, Lord, and which way should I go?